I don't think we ever read Mark's Gospel at Christmas. We look at John's introduction, "In the beginning was the Word." We dip back into the prophet Isaiah with his wonderful counsellor, mighty God, everlasting Father. We turn to Matthew for those two names, Emmanuel, God with us, and Jesus, he shall save his people from their sins. But above all, we retell the story from Luke. Luke is the one who gets the biggest look in at Christmas, and Mark doesn't get a single mention. In some ways, that's not surprising. John takes us back into the eons of eternity. Matthew connects Jesus with King David. Luke interweaves the births of both John the Baptist and Jesus. But Mark doesn't even start until Jesus is 30. However, Mark does have a prologue in which he makes some important introductions. And I want to put it to you in this way. Jesus has come into the world to pick a fight. Now, the nearest thing we have to that in recent history is Nelson Mandela's words in 1961 when he was 43 years old. "I have had to separate myself from my dear wife and children, from my mother and sisters, to live as an outlaw in my own land. I've had to close my business, abandon my profession, and live in poverty and misery as many of my people are doing. The struggle is my life. I will continue fighting for freedom until the end of my days." Now, of course, that's not the first thing you would think of with Jesus. At Christmas, we're tuned into a baby, meek and mild, according to some of the carols we sing. But Mark's in more of a hurry. His is both the first of the Gospels to be written and by far the shortest of the four. Luke's Gospel is almost twice the length if you do a word count. So this Christmas, let's give Mark the oxygen of publicity and let's listen to what he is saying to us about the future ministry of Jesus. In verse 1, he's going to pick a fight with the world. From verses 2 to 11, he's going to pick a fight with religion. And in verses 12 and 13, he's going to pick a fight with himself. And I want to go through one by one. So first of all, he picks a fight with the world. The very first verse of Mark's Gospel says this. "This is the good news about Jesus Christ, the Son of God." Now, one of the problems with reading the Bible is that we read our own assumptions back into the text. So naturally, we think this is Mark stating that Jesus is the Son of God, the second person of the Trinity. Now, of course, Jesus is the Son of God, but we're in danger of missing Mark's point. When Jesus came into the world, he lived in Galilee and he died in Judea. Both were Roman provinces. Most of what we now call Europe, together with those African countries lying between the Mediterranean Sea and the Sahara Desert, these were all under the control of the Roman Empire. And the empire was ruled by the emperor, or Caesar. That word Caesar derives from both the Latin and Greek languages. There were two Caesars whose reigns spanned Jesus' life, Augustus and Tiberius, and they claimed to be sons of God. Now, of course, if you're a humble subject of the empire, you're not going to argue with that. These men were so powerful that they could do what they liked. If they told you to wear a face mask, you wouldn't forget and leave it at home because the potential consequences were dire. You doffed your cap and did whatever they said. The achievements of Augustus are well documented. He built an elaborate system of roads throughout the empire. He erected bridges and beautiful buildings. He restored 82 temples, turned brick into marble, established a good postal service, managed to get a month, the month of August, named after himself. But he was also a monster. He enslaved millions of people, and over the years he executed 2,000 conspirators who wanted to bring him down. When we talk about the other monsters of history, we immediately think of Hitler and the fascists. But for some reason, we hesitate to make the same critique of state socialism. You may recall that when he was Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell approvingly referred to Chairman Mao's Little Red Book. Mao became leader of China in 1949 and presided over some of the worst atrocities in history. In his great leap forward around 60 years ago, he tried to shift China from an agrarian-based economy to an industrial one. He subjected his own people to appalling hardship and repressed those who challenged him. 3 million were tortured and executed, and 45 million died of neglect and starvation. And yet, in China today, Mao has been reinvented. Posters and statuettes can be found everywhere. The truth has been conveniently airbrushed out. History is actually full of such monsters. So when Mark says that Jesus is the Son of God, he's pitting him against such powerful dictators. He's inviting you to reconsider your ideas of what a God is, what power is. For with Jesus, you will encounter someone who is kind, not ruthless, a servant, not a tyrant. And it's no coincidence that Mark ends as he began. As Jesus dies, the centurion keeping order, who has been witness to the vitriolic taunts of the crowds, and yet has also listened to such warm words from this victim, this hard-nosed soldier, raised on the understanding that orders are orders and you do not question the emperor, the absolute ruler, the Son of God, this centurion recognizes something and makes an extraordinary confession. Truly, this man, not Caesar, this man is the Son of God. Secondly, Jesus picks a fight with religion. Now, in verses from verse 2, he says, "It began as the prophet Isaiah had written. God said, 'I will send my messenger ahead of you to open the way for you.' Someone is shouting in the desert, 'Get the road ready for the Lord. Make a straight path for him to travel.'" Now, actually, what you may have missed is that he is not just quoting from Isaiah. He's quoting from two prophets, Malachi and Isaiah. Malachi says, "I will send my messenger who will prepare the way before me. Then suddenly the Lord you are seeking will come to his temple." Whereas Isaiah says, "A voice of one calling in the wilderness, prepare the way for the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God." What's going on here? Is Mark a bit ignorant, mixing up his prophets? Actually, I think Mark is being very astute. He is challenging popular views of the Messiah. People expected their Messiah to come to Jerusalem, sort everything out top down. He would be the Jewish equivalent of the Archbishop of Canterbury. He would come to the temple, the heart of Jewish life. But instead, says Mark, he has come to the desert. Malachi has his messenger coming to the temple, but by merging his prophecy with Isaiah's, Mark has him coming not to the temple, but to the wilderness. And so Mark turns to the ministry of John the Baptist, this unconventional maverick who baptized people in the Jordan River. And then when Jesus appears, he doesn't go to the temple, he goes out to the desert, to John. God begins his work outside the religious centers. There is something about religion that has a tendency to become rotten at the core. You come into a church and find it refreshing initially, but as you become involved, you begin to detect little power struggles and broken relationships. The Old Testament prophets frequently brought this up. "Away with the noise of your songs," says Amos. "I will not listen to the music of your harps, but let justice roll on like a river, righteousness like a never-failing stream." As I often find myself saying these days, we mistakenly prize ritual over relationships, services over service, respectability over humanity and compassion. There was no shortage of religion during centuries of the European empires or in brutal white South Africa during the apartheid years. Religion can easily become corrupt at the core, whether it's big institutions or local churches. In the years following World War II, Londoners travelled some distance to hear the best preachers. Martin Lloyd-Jones had a substantial following at Westminster Chapel, where he was the minister for 25 years. He would draw congregations of 2,000 every Sunday, including many university students. He was succeeded in 1969 by Glyn Owen, a man whose ministry was constantly compared to his predecessor and only lasted 5 years. Then came an American, R.T. Kendall. As he observed London church culture, he was disappointed to find that newcomers to Westminster Chapel were not converts, but transfers from other churches. People were cherry-picking their preachers. So he started a course in evangelism, and he got his members out onto the streets. His wife didn't feel the need to do the course, as she'd been listening to her husband preach for 20 years. But she felt she needed to set a good example, and so one Saturday morning she wandered through St. James's Park giving out tracts. There was little interaction with people until a man in his 20s, wearing a Che Guevara t-shirt, looked at the tract, saw it was about Jesus, and said, "I've got a train to catch at Victoria in 15 minutes. Tell me what I need to know." She was fumbling for words. She'd never given a moment's thought to how she might explain the good news in clear and simple terms, and she felt mortified by her own inability. The following week, she joined the course. Meanwhile, people were getting converted and started coming along to church. Quite a few of the street homeless also showed up on Sunday mornings. The minister was delighted. But one morning, a few elders took him to one side and said, "The people of quality in this church don't like what you're doing." They had listened for years to the sermons of Martin Lloyd-Jones, but they had failed to grasp that simple idea that every person matters. What is it about religious people and religious institutions? So God comes into our world and works from the margins. It may not be a recipe for recognition, but perhaps there's something here that we need to reflect on. Perhaps distancing ourselves from the irrelevant paraphernalia of so much religion and connecting with ordinary people is the way to make a real difference. It will certainly help to keep us rooted in the real world. And finally, he picks a fight with himself. At once the Spirit made him go into the desert, where he stayed 40 days being tempted by Satan. The details of Jesus' struggle with the devil are not important to Mark, but what's interesting is that even within Jesus there was something the devil could appeal to. Matthew and Luke lay out three particular temptations that he faced. Mark just says that he was tempted. He knew that not only did he have to do battle with the world and corrupted religion, he had to do battle with himself. Now, these days we have a tendency to accept the way we are. "That's the way God made me," we say. And so if I'm pushy or short-tempered or rude or unable to hear other people, well, that's just who I am. By contrast, earlier Christian traditions introduce us to the hermit, the person who retreated from the world to do battle with the enemy. Within this raging ego that always thinks I'm right and everyone else is wrong. This is a tradition we have neglected, the searching of the soul, the confronting of the sinful nature. Both Advent and Lent traditionally offer us a time to pause for thought, to look within, to pursue purer lives. And we don't often associate this with Jesus, but he too had to grapple with the enemy within. And so Mark doesn't mess about. Jesus' life is going to be all about struggle, a struggle with the world, with religion, and with his own human nature. And as the gospel story unfolds, we will see him as the one who is not defeated. Steve Turner's Christmas poem springs to mind. "Christmas is really for the children, especially for children who like animals, stables, stars and babies wrapped in swaddling clothes. Then there are wise men, kings in fine robes, humble shepherds and a hint of rich perfume. Easter is not really for the children, unless accompanied by a cream-filled egg. It has whips, blood, nails, a spear, and allegations of body snatching. It involves politics, God and the sins of the world. It's not good for people of a nervous disposition. They would do better to think on rabbits, chickens, and the first snowdrop of spring. Or they'd better do better to wait for a rerun of Christmas without asking too many questions about what Jesus did when he grew up, or whether there's any connection." Well, Mark may not give us Christmas, but he certainly makes the connection, and he goes straight to the heart of the matter. May we not give up the struggle that we are also called to.